Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Steph Smith.
Today, we're going to be talking about practical tips for better traveling. And this is advice coming from two people who have traveled to many dozens of countries over the last few years.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. This is our first podcast after our challenge hangover. The 30 days was pretty rough. If you haven't heard about our 30-day challenge, listen to the last episode. But we're coming back to you on our weekly schedule with a topic that I personally find really interesting, which is traveling, and in particular, potentially traveling while you're working or more so long-term travel. And I think it's really interesting at this particular juncture because throughout the pandemic, a lot more people now work remotely. And I think once more people are vaccinated, once restrictions ease, then we're going to see a lot more people hitting the road to some degree. There's going to be a varying degree. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about what we've experienced, some of the tips we have. I will just caveat and say that I don't want this to come across too much like advice. I think, honestly, a lot of the time, if you want to go travel, the easiest thing that you can do is just book a ticket and hit the road. But hopefully some of this advice or some of our experience will help people if they are venturing into this travel work lifestyle.
So I'm going to take a different frame. I'm actually going to provide some advice because we've learned some stuff over the years and you can travel in whatever way you want. But I do think that after years of iteration, you do learn some things that can help people who are less experienced. So I want to kick it off, Steph. The idea that there are many different types of travelers. And I think this episode should apply to nearly everyone. I break it down into three key buckets. So there's people who travel full-time without a job. These are usually like young backpackers who just graduated from high school, or they're burned out or lost adults who have just gone through something difficult and are going through that crisis and decided to solve it through traveling. Then there's people who travel full-time with a job. These are digital nomads. So you can work for a remote company, you can be a freelancer, or you can be remote at a non-distributed company. Some people fall into that bucket. And then the third one is people who travel part-time with or without a job. So this is classic stuff. So you're going on vacation for a week to travel, you're taking weekend trips, or you're traveling in your home place. I think what we have to say is a little bit less relevant to some of the types of travel in that last bucket, but hopefully there are some useful tidbits because I do think people overpack on average across all types.
Definitely. And I don't know about you, Cal, but I've fit into all three of those buckets at some point in my life. I've done the like student backpacky travel. I've done the long-term digital nomad travel. And I'm probably more like in that third bucket, at least in the last year or so, where it's just transient travel here and there. And I think you're right that the advice probably applies more to long-term digital nomads, but I think it's pretty universal and hopefully this will help people. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was almost touching on those three different buckets that traveling for work or traveling while you're working is much different than traveling just for play per se. So traveling just to travel. And these are different in many ways, but I think the main thing that I want to touch on is just the length of travel, right? So you all know that if you're traveling nomadically, you're probably going to travel for longer, but it not only impacts the sheer like total length that you're traveling, but how you're actually spending time in each respective place. So when I was a backpacker, I was traveling around Southeast Asia and I was going to a new place every couple days, every week. That when you're traveling and working remotely is not sustainable. And in fact, you can go and travel like crazy, especially if you have this newfound freedom. But I think in general, one piece of advice that I'd give, especially if you are working and you have a full-time job, is to spend no less than 1 month in a given place. And that 1 month will give you enough time to get to know the place, to build even just a little bit of a community, and to build some of the habits that enable you to not just go travel as your core priority, but also keep up some of your other habits, like maybe staying healthy or keeping your job.
So I had a very different experience in my first couple years of travel. Actually, 1 year I went to 22 countries. So I totally ignored your advice. And I ultimately converged on the same thing, that spending at least 3 weeks to a month in a place allows you to get to know it better. One other advantage of that is that you get to do things more slowly. I think some of the worst travel trips that I find are you're in a place for 3 days, there's lots of things to do, and you try to get to everything, and you just end up rushing around and not really enjoying it. And you may like the experience in your memory, but the actual experience is rushed and not what I personally like out of travel. So I do think giving yourself an extra buffer and saying, hey, I'll see one fewer city on this trip, but I'm cool with that because I'll have a more pleasant time wherever I am and really just get to wander around. That's another reason I like the idea of staying a little bit longer.
Yeah. And tied to that point, I think myself and basically every long-term nomad that I've talked to has converged on that. So of course you can do what a lot of people do, which both of us did, which is go and travel like crazy to start, go see a bunch of places. I would liken it to almost like a sugar rush where yes, one chocolate bar sounds amazing and you're stoked to eat it, but the second one is slightly less amazing. And then in a short period of time, eating 10 chocolate bars is really enjoyable at all. And I think the same thing is true. If you really pack all of this travel into such a short time period, especially as you're working, it can get really exhausting. And then you're really just doing it for the reps. You're just doing it to say, oh, I went to another country. And what's much more, I think, fulfilling is if you do it at a slower pace. Now, the exact pace is up to you. It's up to your goals, what you enjoy, where you want to get to. But I found that minimum a month later on, especially after a year of travel, seems to be what longer-term nomads converge on. And actually, most long-term nomads, I think, spend at minimum more like 3 to 6 months in places.
I generally agree. I will say that for those of you who just have a couple of weeks per year to travel, or you're just going to go on like a month of travel, feel free to go to a bunch of places. I think what we're saying here definitely applies more if you want to do a sustainable long-term travel.
Yes. And I think in general, just be realistic, right? If you've traveled before and you mostly have done that on a vacation, that is so much different than traveling while you're working and having those other commitments.
Another idea on this topic of how do you make working while traveling a better experience? I think picking the right location and the right apartment or housing setup is really important. Do you have any tips there based on the many dozens of places you've stayed?
Yeah. So let's break that into two. So one, thinking about the like overall place, like what city, what country potentially, and then how to actually think about wherever you're physically staying or what places that you might be renting. So the first part, I think it's one of those things where there's no correct answer. Tons of people are going to be happy in a majority of places that they go. The way that I would think about it, especially if you're traveling and working, is to find locations that primarily have a couple different things. The way that I've seen a lot of nomads think about it is perhaps just because of the types of work that they do, but they're looking for, of course, good Wi-Fi. So if you can find a place with good internet and potentially good co-working spaces, that's huge. A community of other nomads. So now I think we're going to see more of these, but in the past that was really concentrated in a couple places like Canggu, Chiang Mai, Lisbon, Medellin. There are more than that, but there were some really concentrated places and that could help with building community quickly. And then there are some other things like cheap cost of living, good weather that generally people converge around. And that's why if you're interested in starting somewhere where you're going to, I think, just have a better first experience more easily, it's not impossible to have a great first experience in places outside of these places. But if you want to increase your chances of that, then I think just going to a place like Nomadlist and starting with one of those is your best option. I didn't do that. And I don't think you did that either. But if I were to start from scratch today, that's where I would first look.
Yeah, so that would be nomadlist.com. It's a website that ranks different cities based on criteria, and it can help you prioritize what you're looking for out of a place. Another one I'd add to what you said is time zone. And then I just want to comment on the weather thing as well. Something that I think the majority of people that I met on the road were doing was season hopping. So it's summer in South America during the winter in North America and vice versa. And so people would go places based on when the weather was good. I think that helps your travel for a few reasons. One, you don't have to deal with really cold or bitter conditions. And two, you can pack a lot lighter when you're just going to warm places. You don't have to carry big backpacks. And that really helps your travel just be a lot lighter. But that's one reason I might start in warmer places, because you can start with a lighter load.
Yeah, it's escaping winter. I've escaped winter successfully for the past, I think, 3 or 4 years, which has been very enjoyable, especially from someone who grew up in Toronto. I think you're also right about the time zones. That's really key. And in general, my advice here is don't overthink this. A lot of people, especially when they're first starting out, I think I had a similar issue when I was trying to decide where to go. And the idea is that, again, you're going to be happy in a lot of different places. And the best thing about travel and having the flexibility to work from wherever you want is that if you don't like it, you just pack your bags and go somewhere else. So don't overthink it. Don't try to find the exact perfect place to start. Just go somewhere. And I'm sure that once you start traveling and getting that momentum going, you're going to see so many different opportunities of new places to go. And that's why I think just if you aren't sure and you're like, I don't know how to think about this, the easiest place to start is just through something like Nomadlist. I think that gives you a pretty high chance of success if you start with any of, let's say, the top five on that.
Just two comments on what you said. The first is on time zone. So I went to all of the different time zones while working for a US-based company who worked on EST. I found that anything in South America was fine. Some countries are better than others because you're ahead or behind. Europe was really interesting because you think, oh, I have to work late at night. But what's really cool about Europe is you have the mornings free. And so you actually don't have to log on until 1 or 2. And I really like that because I love the mornings and I don't like working right away. So Europe ended up being interesting in that perspective for me. And of course, you work a little bit later into the night, but that works as well because often people eat dinner later in Europe. The one I really didn't like while working for a US company was Asia, where I would have to take calls in the middle of the night. I just need a little bit more of a structured sleep schedule. Some people, I know like you, are fine to work funky hours and to adjust your schedule.
I thrived in Asia. I loved it.
Yeah. I don't think most people thrive taking calls at 3 or 4 a.m. And that certainly was a constraint for me that if I was working for a US-based East or West Coast company, I probably wouldn't stay there for too long and might try to overlap it with a vacation.
Yes, totally. I think the takeaway is that as you start traveling, especially if you're just starting to work remotely and you're also getting used to flexible timelines and schedules, then I think what you're going to find is you're going to naturally see, oh, I really work in Europe like you did, Cal, because I have my mornings. Interestingly enough, as you said, I think most people don't like working on that Asia time zone if they're cross-referencing with Americas. But for me, what I loved is I would basically wake up in the morning, I'd have a bunch of Slack messages, but people would send me those Slack messages through my night knowing that I was in Asia, so they didn't have the immediate expectation that I'd respond. And then I'd respond to those Slack messages. I'd have the full day to myself to get things done and to just orient my day how I wanted. And then yes, at night, sometimes I'd have to stay up quite late and adhere to those calls. But I loved that time zone for the asynchronous nature of just having so much time to get stuff done. But overall, wherever you go, you're going to find that certain time zones work better for you. And even better, if you have less of a call-based job, then you're going to have even more freedom in where you go.
Absolutely. I know we suggested that people go to Nomad List for cities, but just personally, cities I would recommend if you're just getting started and want to do long-term travel that were good. Lisbon in Portugal, Medellin in Colombia, Mexico City is pretty good, Buenos Aires in Argentina. And what else would I do? I think those are some good starting points because they have really well-established nomad communities. Most of them have good internet and they each have lots of things to do and explore and great food. And that will just make the experience better. And I think most of them have pretty good weather most of the year as well.
Yes. And if you're open to Asia, Canggu and Chiang Mai, I think are the most prominent hubs in that area. So let's move on to the second part of that, which is the housing situation. If you're going somewhere new, how do you actually find housing? How do you think about housing? This is obviously going to depend on your budget, your needs, et cetera. But what I've found most effective is, especially if you have a full-time job, don't stay in hostels. It sounds obvious, but I stayed in hostels for a very long time. You won't get good Wi-Fi. You won't get good sleep. You just will have a tougher life, especially if you're working. Now, with that said, whether you stay in Airbnb, a long-term co-living space, these are all due to your preferences. But something that I will say, because I've seen lots of people do this wrong, is if you are going especially to a low cost of living place, let's say in Canggu, if you go on Airbnb, everything is going to be like 3x the price that it is in that actual place because they know that from Western countries are coming there and they know that they're willing to spend more. So one piece of advice is if you are going especially to somewhere like Canggu or Chiang Mai, to potentially book an Airbnb or a hostel or a hotel for a couple days and then book something in the actual place when you're there because you're going to get the cheaper rates. You're going to actually be able to see things. And if you're not willing to do that because you want your whole accommodation booked beforehand, then Airbnb, but find people on Airbnb and message them directly because especially again, in these cheap cost of living places, you're going to be paying like 3x if you book directly through Airbnb.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. I actually hadn't thought about this beforehand, but did this a bunch of times. I would just rent an Airbnb for 2 or 3 days and then get a sense of the local landscape and just go around. There's a lot of places as well that operate on underground cash economies. And so one example was I was recently in a little town in Mexico and I rented a place on Airbnb and then I found another one that was cool on Airbnb and I just found the guy and talked to him one off because someone had stayed there. And I think the price was like 30% lower. I generally actually stayed mostly in Airbnbs, so I wasn't trying to skirt the system. And that was partially because I like that you have the contract with the host and you have the security of knowing where you're going. But there are certain places, like you're talking about Canggu, where it does not make sense to just book Airbnb full time and you're really doing yourself a disservice.
Exactly. And I think two other things I will note on finding accommodation is one. You actually taught me this, but if you are working, make sure to send your Airbnb or wherever you're staying a Wi-Fi test request. This is super easy. You just send them like a speed test site that they can send you back, and it takes them 30 seconds and you can see how good their Wi-Fi is. If it's not good, that's going to be a huge struggle for you. Of course, you can go to co-working spaces and such, but it's really important you have good Wi-Fi in your place of accommodation. And then the second thing is, I've found this to be really important. Maybe others won't, but prioritizing your location is, I think, much more important than prioritizing something that's slightly lower cost. If you are in not necessarily the like tourist area of a place, but if things that are important to you, let's say a co-working space, a gym, not being totally outside of where things are happening, then you're going to have a much better experience. So I personally have found that prioritizing or finding where other nomads are or where kind of that community is that you want to be a part of, and prioritizing staying in or close to that location is going to make your experience much better.
One thing I found a little bit difficult is actually knowing where to go, what neighborhood to stay in before you actually get to a place. And so sometimes I ended up staying in areas where I wouldn't have preferred to stay there had I known the location. And that's another advantage of just booking a couple of days, getting to know the city. Do you like the artsy neighborhood? Do you like the more vibrant city? Do you like closer to the beach? Whatever it is in that location that you want to prioritize, that's another helpful tip there. I will also leave the message that I use to Airbnb hosts in the podcast description. It's basically something like, hey, I'm a remote traveler. I'm excited to stay in your... Could you just run an internet speed test? Just Google this and send me what that speed test says. And then I had some criteria. I think it was like 10 download speed and 2 upload speed at a minimum that would allow me to take video calls. And that saved me a bunch of times from ending up in places with sketchy Wi-Fi. The one thing that doesn't control for is sometimes people, when they run a speed test, have good Wi-Fi, but the Wi-Fi is actually spotty throughout the day. So it goes, you know, in and out based on the local conditions. And so that's something you really can't predict. I never personally had a lot of troubles there. But one piece of advice is, when you get to a place, instead of getting your cell phone plan linked to a specific country, which you can't always get or it's really expensive, go ahead and bring an unlocked phone with you. You can do this with your iPhone, and then get a local SIM card either at the airport or close to where you're staying, that just from any like telecom provider. That usually costs somewhere between $10 and $25, and you'll get 5 megabytes of data that you can then use as a hotspot in case your Wi-Fi is spotty. And that saved me in a bunch of cases, including when I'm in between trips or something goes wrong and I'm on a bus and need to take a call.
One note on that is that if you're from North America, what I see a lot of people do is that they just open up their phone plan so that they can get data abroad. That is going to be so much more expensive than getting a local SIM card. Data in general in North America is, I think, the highest prices of anywhere in the world. And so even if you go to places like, I lived in Indonesia for a while, the data in Indonesia is so fast and so cheap that you can get like many tens of gigs for like $10, and you can tether, you can use it for a hotspot. So totally agree with that. And one thing to just note is, often you can buy the SIM card at the airport or, like you said, somewhere in town. But a lot of these countries are also a little more advanced in their ability to top things up through apps. So if you're in Asia in particular, like, you can top up your SIM card with an app instead of having to go into the telecom store. And so just be aware that these are options.
The other advantage of the local SIM card is you get a local phone number. And so it's easier to make calls if you want to make reservations or talk to people locally, which can actually come in handy. And then you may wonder what you do with your actual phone number. Like, how do people get a hold of you? Through iMessage, if you have an iPhone, people can still text you. And then I did most of my messaging on WhatsApp with all of my friends or family or the people I was meeting on the road. And with WhatsApp, regardless of the SIM card that you have in your phone, you can just keep the same phone number.
And if you're like, man, I don't really want to do all this stuff, I just want to have the same phone number, the most popular option that I've heard from nomads is Google Fi. If you're American, you can't get it if you're not American, but that gives you access to, I think, over 100 countries. And just when you show up in that country, you already have data. It is more expensive than if you were to go with a local option, but just worth mentioning that.
Cool. One perspective on housing that I wanted to provide is, I stayed in Airbnbs for most of my time abroad, literally in every place. And on average, it ends up being cheaper than North America, depending on where you're staying, even though Airbnb is more expensive, perhaps to the lowest absolute place that you can get. I liked Airbnb because there was often a lot of inventory. The people were reliable. And also, I could find a place that was just going to fit my needs for being able to work and travel. So I always prioritize a place that may have had a desk, or I would pay a little bit more just to have extra space, because you just don't want to be space compressed when you're on the road. Another general principle I had was, I never got a place that was too nice, in part because I wanted to motivate myself to get out and explore the city instead of just staying in my really nice Airbnb that was way nicer than whatever I could afford in New York. I think it was cool to always have like good places with nice features and you feel like you're living like a king or a queen in these different places. But at the same time, I think there's a balance there. And it's why I never stayed in hotels too, besides them being more expensive. I felt like I would have spent more time inside instead of actually getting out and experiencing the city in which I was living in.
Yeah, just as a comparison related to what we had mentioned before, I would much rather stay in something in the heart of wherever I wanted to be, where things are walkable or bikeable, and I can access things really easily. That is less nice, like having an Airbnb, let's say, that's less nice in the heart of things. I would prefer that relative to a really nice Airbnb that is even, let's say, a 15-minute drive outside of the heart of things. That just completely changes your experience in those places. And so I would always personally prioritize the location and less so about the glamorousness of an Airbnb.
And one cool thing, if you're staying in countries outside of North America, in 2017, I spent, I think, 340 days outside of the US. And so basically all of my time. And I stayed in Airbnbs and ones that I thought were nice. My total monthly housing costs for that year was $788 per month. And that was including all the Airbnb fees and all of that. And I had just come from New York where I was paying, I think, $1,500 plus a month for a small one-bedroom apartment. And that was pretty cool. I pretty much halved my housing and was staying in much more badass places.
Yes. And I know most people already know this, but you can get even cheaper than that. Not saying that you should, but if you stay in certain places, if you go to certain places around the world, the cost of living can be so much cheaper. So for example, one of my friends a while back knew that I was living in Bali and he was like, what could I get for $10,000 in Bali? And I was like, you literally couldn't spend $10,000 a month in Bali. It would be very difficult. You could have someone cook for you, someone clean for you, a really nice place. Not saying that this is how you should spend, but I'm just giving that comparison that yes, it is much cheaper depending on where you go. I wanted to give a couple more just general pieces of advice before maybe we go into packing. So one thing to just keep in mind is that, especially if you're coming from North America, the one place that I think you can get scammed pretty easily is the airport. And in particular, one thing to just be aware of is that Uber, which we're so used to now, is illegal in some countries. So just be aware of that before you go to certain countries.
Just thought of lots of things as it relates to airports. So one thing I did, because in all, as you mentioned, in some places, Uber's illegal. In other places, you have taxis that scam you. In other places, I actually almost got kidnapped once in Nicaragua.
Yeah, just one note on that is the reason I mentioned airports is because I think in general, a lot of people will say like the world is scary. And most of the time, the world is actually pretty safe and people are there to help you. The one place that I think you can get scammed very easily is the airport, because people know that's where to target people. They know people who are coming to their country for the first time. And it's just like a filtering mechanism to see who can we scam. So that's the place where I think just be really alert.
I do think on average, the world is a lot safer and nicer than you would think. And that was actually one of my key takeaways from all of the travel was people are just generally kind. And of course, there are exceptions. But one piece of advice on the airport is this is, I often did very little research before going to a place just so I could experience it for the first time. That was one of my personal principles, instead of looking at the images and then seeing them in real life and being like, wow, that looks pretty much like the image. What I would do with the airport in particular is I would look up how do I get from the airport to my place and what are the actual options beforehand. And I would also do things like star my Airbnb address on my Google Maps and make sure that was downloaded, and also see the route from the airport just in case I didn't have data or Wi-Fi if there was no SIM card place at the airport itself. And that way I would be able to actually navigate at least to my Airbnb or somewhere close to it without any troubles. If you try to determine that in the place, it's really hard to filter through the noise and the different people trying to get you to do different things. So that was just one piece of research I always did.
Another thing for airports is, this is going to sound really dumb, but look up the currency conversion rate before you land, because especially if you don't have any data, this happened to me once. You go to an ATM, a lot of ATMs in certain airports will know that you don't know the currency conversion, and the denominations that they'll give you are extremely high. You can, of course, select something else. So this actually happened to me in Budapest. I went to an ATM, didn't look up the currency conversion before. I assumed the lowest denominator that they would give me was $20. In reality, it was $200. So when I actually went to take out $200, I ended up taking out $2,000, which I was only in Budapest for 5 days. And again, a really cheap cost of living place. So just be aware of that. Sounds obvious, but just one of those things in the airports, they know you're new.
So I have two tips as it relates to money and ATMs. I think a lot of people, especially if you haven't had a lot of experience traveling, you will convert your cash. So you'll take like US dollars and you'll go to one of the currency conversion stands in the airport or do it before you go. You always get the worst rates when you do that. And I would never do that unless you absolutely had to. Bring maybe 200 US dollars just to keep in your back pocket in case of some sort of emergency, but don't trade that for cash. Instead, you can use ATMs, which I think, as you mentioned, sometimes you get better rates or not better rates. One little hack I had was I set up a high yield checking / investing account with Charles Schwab. And with this, they actually gave me an ATM card that would reimburse me for any foreign ATM withdrawal fees. So banks like Chase and Bank of America, they charge you like $5 to $7 on top of the fees you're already getting at the ATMs. So with this Charles Schwab card, I could basically not pay any ATM fees, which when I was traveling full time could add up a lot, especially in countries where you need a lot of cash. And what I could do is I could protect my money in the sense that I only put a certain amount of money on that card because I wasn't going to be withdrawing many thousands of dollars out of ATMs at once. And so I basically had a card that I could bring around that only had $1,000 to $2,000 at most on it that didn't charge me fees. And that was a really useful thing for me in terms of taking out money and saving some costs.
This is actually a really important point, the point about ATMs and potentially having card scanners on them. This depends on obviously where you're going. In a place like Toronto, this is very unlikely to happen. In a place like Bali, it's extremely common for ATMs to basically have card readers on them that can scam you out of your money. It's so common that in Chengdu, it was more often that people asked which ATMs didn't have card readers, which ones were dependable versus the ones that weren't. And often if you're in a place and you're unsure, the best route is just to go to any sort of ATM that's within a bank. Those ones are not going to have any sort of scammers that are able to manipulate them. And so just be aware of that. It obviously depends where you are, but that is something to keep in mind. And as you said, Cal, the best piece of advice is just to use a card that has an amount of money that would obviously suck if you lost it, but not your whole savings account, because this has happened to people and you can lose a lot of money if you're not careful.
One thing I always do with ATMs, and I don't know if this protects against card readers, but I always put my hand over the PIN pad when I'm entering it. Maybe that doesn't actually protect you, but that's something that I always do as well.
I think there's many different types of card readers. Some of them are more sophisticated than others, but I would just be careful in case.
Definitely.
And one other note on that is that you mentioned a card within the United States. There are also other cards within Canada, and I'm sure other countries that give you the same thing where you don't get charged to take out money from the ATM. And this isn't going to save you a life-changing amount of money. But if you are traveling a lot, most places abroad take cash pretty heavily. And so just keep that in mind.
This comes into play in some countries pretty heavily. Like I know in Nicaragua, I could barely use a credit card. And so you really had to use a lot of cash, including sometimes for your accommodation.
You can go down a very deep rabbit hole when it comes to some of these cards. I chose not to go down that rabbit hole very much, but I do know, especially within the United States, Cal, you have this awesome card, which allows you to get lounge access, which is a very nice perk. In Canada, I really struggled to find anything that would allow you to do this. I think you had to pay a very hefty fee if you wanted one, versus why don't you just share what you have in...
Sure. So it's pretty common in the US to have this, but I have the Chase Sapphire Reserve. There's, I think, a multi-$100 fee on the card, but you get $300 back in travel rewards. You get credits against Peloton memberships. You get all kinds of things. And before going into the lounge part, at least pick a card, whether it's a Sapphire Reserve or not, that doesn't have any foreign transaction fees. And that gives you bonus points for travel-related items like taxis and meals, which the Chase Sapphire Reserve does really well at. I don't know if it's the best travel card, but it's pretty good. And I think you would do well with it. The thing that has been awesome, though, is it gives you a free priority pass, which gives you access to lounges across the world. And actually, you get many more lounge accesses in foreign countries than in the US, though there are some in the US. This is really useful if you're just on a long layover or you want to save money in the airport. Every time you go into the lounge, you can get like water, you could get booze if you wanted, you can often get food, and that's going to save you $20+ often because airports are so expensive. And one cool little hack is in the Bangkok airport, in which I was pretty sick and not feeling good, I was able to get a free massage in the Bangkok Priority Pass lounge. So that was awesome.
Yeah. And most of the time, depending on the airport, the Wi-Fi isn't great, but within a lounge, they typically have better Wi-Fi. And in general, it's just really nice when you're traveling to be able to go to a lounge. I, for many years, did not have this access. Now, it is worth noting that you can buy the Priority Pass as is. You can just buy it directly and have that access. I think it costs $400 a year, though. So if you can get it with any sort of credit card, it's a pretty sick perk.
I don't know which one I have. I'm looking at their site, but there's a $99 card, a $299 one, and a $429 one. Not sure which one Chase Sapphire gives you, but
I think it's the big one.
Then that's awesome. And makes the card almost worth it in and of itself. The last cool thing on that card is you can bring a guest every time. And so you, if you're traveling with a buddy or traveling with a girlfriend, they can always pop into the lounge with you. You always get one guest. And that's a nice little perk to be able to provide people. And I know, Steph, I've gotten you into lounges many times and you've been super grateful for that.
So you definitely have the top one because basically the $99 one just gets you a cheaper fee each time you want to go to the lounge. The $299 gets you 10 free visits. Then it's $32 per extra visit. And then yours is the amazing unlimited fee. Actually, I think yours is even better because the $429 one still says that a guest fee is $32. So you probably have some crazy $999 version of the Priority Pass, and I definitely benefit from it sometimes.
Wow, I'm living large. One last note on finances since we're talking about it. I did this little trick where I carry two wallets when I'm traveling. Usually one is a skinny wallet, actually both kind of are. And in the wallet that I bring around in day-to-day life, I just have a credit card. I have that no-fee transaction debit card. I have my like health card and my ID. But I have very little else other than that. And so I have a second wallet with many more cards in it. And that way, if I ever lose my wallet, I'm only losing some percentage of the cards that I need to be able to function and use in the world. And I also never bring my passport going around because you really don't need it, with the exception of very few cases. And that has saved me, I think, a bunch of times, at least mentally, because if you're out there getting drunk or someone pickpockets you, or just you lose your wallet because you leave it somewhere, you don't have this catastrophic situation where you literally don't have any of your cards. And so I think that's a simple way to protect yourself. I've taken this even more extreme in places like Brazil, where it's somewhat more likely that you would get robbed. I actually would just carry around an ID, and then I would carry around cash in my pocket and some cash in my shoe as well. And that was a way to hopefully protect myself against any sort of robbery, although that never happened.
It happened to me and I was just giggling at your shoe. I've never done that before, but it happened to me. I lost basically everything other than my passport when I was flying into Costa Rica one time. It was terrible. You have to do a lot. I had to basically borrow money from the hostel I was staying at. I actually only found out once I had gotten into a shared taxi with some people. So someone had to pay for that taxi. I had to get money through Western Union. You lose a lot of money when you do that. And so it was really terrible. And I have learned my lesson since. I would definitely encourage people to do what Cal said. One other thing that reminded me of, though, if you have things stolen or lost on your trip, most credit cards have something called purchase protection, which a lot of people don't know about. And all it is, it means that when you buy something, as long as it's bought on your credit card, then you have typically a 90-day period where if it gets lost or stolen, literally if you lose it, you've done this before, right, Cal, where you've like left something on a plane, you can then claim that with your credit card company and they will pay you back for that purchase. Now, of course, you don't want to get too frivolous with this and just lose things all the time. Some people do abuse this. I don't encourage that. But it's really nice, if especially if you bought something new like an iPhone. I did this once and I lost my iPhone within the month that I bought it. I bought it new, unlocked. And at that time, I actually didn't know about purchase protection. So I didn't benefit from this. But it's worth noting because I've told so many people about this and I would say a majority of people didn't know it existed.
I've benefited a ton from purchase protection and I think like many thousands of dollars. I left a pair of AirPods on a plane once and I literally just lost them and they actually gave me the full refund. The same is true for cracking an iPhone screen. And that's a really cool thing. Get a good card like the Chase Sapphire Reserve. Most cards have purchase protection. I think some of the Chase ones have, you know, really good customer service as it relates to that. And that can be really useful. The other thing too is get a good card that when you book a rental car, they actually provide you insurance. And that way you don't have to pay rental car insurance. I do that with the Chase card as well. I never buy rental car insurance. And I've actually had a situation where I like ran into just a small curb in San Francisco and it scratched the car and it was like $1,300, but it was paid for by that card without any insurance, which is just another nice feature and way to put your mind at ease from.
Yeah, I know we're veering a lot, so I'll end the credit card discussion here. But in general, read what your credit card offers. It often offers a lot more than you think. So it also offers typically somewhere between 2 to 3 weeks of travel insurance, again, as long as it's booked on the card itself. So that doesn't really help you if you're doing long-term travel. But if you are doing a 2 to 3 week trip, you often don't actually need to buy travel insurance. And if you are interested in travel insurance and being a nomad, then I think one company, I'm not affiliated with them, is Safety Wing, in terms of providing some long-term travel insurance for nomads.
So Steph, it turns out that we have a lot more to say on this than I originally anticipated, which I think makes sense because we spent so much of our lives on the road. I want to finish with a couple of principles. I know we wanted to talk about what to bring on the road, but why don't we save that for a separate episode where we can dive deep into some principles of how to think about packing, really useful items that you'll find, and just some ideas for better packing.
Yeah, let's do it. I have a couple notes there, but I guess we'll do part two.
Cool. So a couple other things I wanted to talk about to make travel just a better experience for you. These are almost like principles that I learned while on the road that I think a lot of people get wrong up front. I'm just going to go down the list and see if any of them resonate with you.
Let's do it.
So the first is just to capture some, but not all moments. And this goes to something where I think a lot of people, they go to places, they see cool things, they want to share it with their friends. So they pull out their phone and they go take pictures of every moment. And I think it's great to have pictures because you can look back and see the memories. So definitely don't not take pictures, but also don't overdo it. And so one little rule I always implemented for myself, if I saw something really cool that I wanted to take a picture of, I sat and looked at it for at least 1 minute before I pulled out my phone. And that way my first experience with the mountain or the ocean or the beautiful building was actually me just looking at that building and appreciating it and trying to take it in. And then I take the photos later. And that way I'm not just looking at it through the lens of the camera, which I think a lot of people end up doing and is the default. And that to me actually led to a lot more enjoyment out of travel. And I still was able to capture the memories.
I am so bad at this, but I think it's great advice. Something that just reminded me of is a lot of people these days, because we have access to Instagram, go to Instagram places. Like you all know about the place in Turkey, Cappadocia, with hot air balloons, about like all of these like very Instagrammable places because all the Instagrammers go to those same places. Now, there's nothing wrong with going to those places, but I would just say that one, they can be really disappointing because of course they're like framed in such a beautiful way to start. But also a lot of these places tend to not really be near other things that are enjoyable as well. So you might go see the thing for 30 seconds and then you're just in this like random town in the middle of nowhere and you don't have other things to do. So I would say prioritize places where, of course, maybe you can go see the cool Instagram thing, but it's also near other things that are enjoyable or near cities or towns that you actually want to spend time in.
I think that's a good tip. A second one, just on the idea of improving your experience. I didn't always do this well, but I'm really happy that I did it sometimes, which is to keep a journal. So I kept a journal about my experiences, things I was learning, and I actually do regularly look back on it and surprised at the thoughts that I was having. And I remember all kinds of people that I met and the places I saw in ways that my memory just doesn't allow me to retrieve. And so keeping a little journal, even if it's just a quick thing where you talk about the mundane stuff that you did on a given day, I think your future self will really appreciate that if you make the time. And it's easy not to do that. And honestly, I would have forgotten so many of the things that were really important and meaningful had I not done that.
I think you mentioned this at the beginning. The whole travel experience after the fact is rose-colored and you just look back on everything of that was so much fun. But I think it's important to actually have some sort of like record of how you were really feeling. And I don't know, it's just cool to look back on that.
You need to find some ways to log it. So photos, writing, you may have some art that you create that it was inspired by your travel. You may write poetry. Sometimes I did that. And I think just whatever you're feeling in the moment can be really cool looking back. The next set of topics I want to talk about though is like, how do you interact with a place or with people? And so these are just some obvious ideas that I found to really enhance my travel experience. So the first one is just, it's simple, but be respectful. I think I see a lot of people, they go to places, they're really loud and boisterous, and they're not really respectful of the local culture. All I have to say there is just know that you're in a foreign place and know that people are mostly welcoming and kind, but make sure that you give them that same respect. And you don't necessarily have the right or the privilege to just go and stomp around just because you paid a lot of money to be there. Like, just find ways to interact with people in humble ways.
One example of this is I once saw someone running through the streets of Vietnam with an American flag on July 4th, and it just didn't seem very respectful. So just try to be respectful.
It seems like a no-brainer, but you don't always see that on the road. Another one is just to be curious. You can cultivate this in different ways, but I think the people you meet or the things you're seeing in different cultures, sometimes it can be really at odds with the values or the norms in your current home country and can be off-putting to you. I know people in South America are a little bit more brash as it relates to how they speak with women. And there are other things that you'll see that may be really off-putting to you. What I found is that instead of judging those people or that culture, try to understand it, try to figure out why it exists in the way that it does. And I think sometimes you'll find that there's more connections to your home culture than you'll think. And you'll also find new modalities of thinking or ways of being that really resonate that you can bring back home and improve the quality of your life.
Cool. What's next?
The third idea here is just to say hello. So if you see a stranger that looks interesting, or this isn't about saying hello, but a building that you find intriguing, even if it's not on your itinerary for the day, say hello or go into the building. Go explore in ways that you may not normally do in your place of origin, because that often leads to the coolest memories or things that are just really fun. That can be a nice way to travel in this unfettered way without sticking to a strict plan. Which brings me to my final point there about just ways of being in a country. I never looked up things before I went, generally speaking, so I could see it for the first time. I also didn't feel the need to see all of the main touristy sites or to go into every museum, things that I did when I was first traveling, because I realized that just moving a little bit more slowly improves your experience on the road. And it also can lead you to find new things or to engage with the place in a way that's not just seeing the sites, but actually being there and feeling what it's like to live in Rio or to live in Argentina and to understand the people. To me, that's actually a more rewarding form of travel, and doesn't mean don't go see the sites, but I think keep your itinerary a little bit less packed than you might think you should.
Yeah, leave room for some fun, some serendipity.
Exactly. Final idea around this is, when I was traveling, I actually didn't have a plan, and I was traveling full time. I didn't have a home. I just flew from place to place, and sometimes I would hear about awesome places from other people, and I basically left space in my map of where I want to go, and that led to sometimes some uncertainty about where I would go next, but that also led to this journey of just meandering through the world in ways that were mostly just following my interest or seeing cool places that I had never heard of that other people talked to me about. If you were thinking about engaging in long-term travel, I would not start with a 3 to 6 month itinerary that's fully planned out. I would maybe plan month one, go there, see how it goes, see what you like, see what you don't like, and go from there instead of trying to map it all out beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no way if you set a 6 month itinerary that you will stick to it as a nomad. I just think it would be really hard because, as you said, so many things pop up. You'll meet people, you'll find out about new adventures, you'll find out about new places, and just why not leave room for that to manifest instead of planning everything out in advance, when, especially if you haven't traveled very much before, very little about what exists out there.
But you may follow that plan if you're, you know, falling victim to the sunk cost fallacy, or you're anchored, or it was just really expensive and you can't afford the other thing. And so that's why I think it makes sense not to really have it, to allow that space to just see things.
Yeah, I think part of that is, you mentioned the sunk cost fallacy. I think also some people think that if they book really far in advance, that means they'll save money. And it's probably true. Yes, if you book your flight 3 months in advance, you'll probably have a cheaper flight than if you book it 2 weeks in advance. Same thing goes for accommodation, or you can save money by planning in advance. But I would say the reward of having some of these experiences and being open to them is much better than saving maybe 20% or even 50% of your total trip's cost.
I don't even think you would save that much. It's 20% at most if you really booked in advance. Like, I always book flights the week of, and they didn't end up being more expensive, especially if you have the flexibility to book flights in the middle of the week. Most people fly on the weekends. I would fly on the Wednesday afternoon or Wednesday evening, and I could make that work with the job that I had. And you save way more doing that than you do when you book in advance. One practical manifestation of leaving space is, I actually would go to a place and I would surprisingly like it more than I thought. Or I'd go to a place and I'd be like, wow, I saw everything in a couple of days. And so I would have the freedom to stay longer in the places that I really enjoyed and was vibing with, and also to move on from the places that weren't quite what I thought of them beforehand. And I really enjoyed that because it created just a better rhythm.
I think traveling's like dating, where you want to go see a bunch of places, but a lot of them will be different to what you expect. And like you said, I think a lot of people get stuck in the sunk cost fallacy of, oh, I plan to spend a month here, but if it sucks or if you're not enjoying it, then go somewhere else. And similarly, if you love something, like, why not spend 3 to 6 months in that place?
I think you'll also find that some places are really awesome to visit for a few days. I think Barcelona falls in this camp, and people are like, I love Barcelona. If you live in Barcelona for 3 months, which I've done before, it's not quite the same city as when you visit for 3 days. I think it's an awesome city to visit for 3 days. Some people probably love living there too. But then there are other cities where they're not that awesome to visit, but they are really enjoyable to live for a few weeks or months. And you don't really know that until you get there and you can figure out what resonates with you. But that's another framework where I think a lot of the places you hear about, you need to know, similar to investing, like, what was the purpose of your trip? Was it a 3-day bender, or was it a month-long stay where you want to get productive work done and live a good life?
Yeah, likening it to relationships again, it's like, some places are good for a one-night stand and some places are good for a long-term relationship, depending on your goals. So yeah, go find that out. Go think about what you actually want. And tied to that, I always have people say, Steph, what's your favorite place? And like you said, it really depends. Is it my favorite place to live long-term? Is it the place I think I want to raise my kids in? Is it a place for me to go have a week of fun with friends? Those are all very different places. And so it's important to go explore a lot and figure out what you want. If you want to spend time in a place for longer, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. The last piece I wanted to talk about was just how to find good restaurants and bars and how to capture your experience. One thing that I did, which it's not perfect because you don't always find the right things and they can be hacked, but I use Google in specific ways. So things that I would do is if I wanted good food, I would get to my Airbnb and I'd say like best food or best restaurants. And then I'd go look at the Google reviews. Usually anything between 4.3 and 4.7 stars is legit. 4.8 and higher, they've probably hacked their reviews. It's unlikely that they're actually that good. And I would star those places on the map and places that I went to, because now when I look at my Google Maps, I actually see stars across the world. And if someone asks me for recommendations for a place, I can just zoom into that place and see all the places that I went and forgot about. I actually used to keep a spreadsheet, but that became too burdensome. So that's a cool way to actually remember where you went and to provide recommendations later on. The other thing is, don't Google like best restaurants on a desktop or something and look at the search results, because those are usually from shitty websites like Thrillist, and the restaurants there are not that great. I do think just searching on Google Maps is a good proxy, and then ask locals what they like as well, because often some of the best restaurants aren't really doing that well on Google because they don't prioritize reviews. But I do find that's a decent way to get to some of the better.
Yeah. And one little trick, and I'm sure a lot of people already do this, is to look up the restaurant on Instagram. Now, don't judge it based on like how many influencers are Instagramming it, but more so if you're at a restaurant or if you're thinking about a restaurant, you can go look at that restaurant's Instagram just to see if the food looks good. Of course, you can't tell if it tastes good quite yet, but a combination between the Google reviews and then what I've really liked is being able to see the food. So Instagram sometimes helps with that.
That's interesting. I've never done that.
Now you will.
So Steph, that was a ton of information. I actually had a lot of fun with this one because I'm remembering all the things that I used to do on the road, and we've traveled a bunch together as well that we often did on the road. And there's all these like fun things. I'm sure we didn't cover a lot, but I hope this was just practical and useful for people listening. That was the goal of this episode. I learned a lot of this stuff over time and made a lot of mistakes along the way. And I'm excited for our next one about what to bring on the road and how to think about that, because I think that's another important piece of just optimizing your experience without thinking too much about it and making sure that you get the most out of the time you spend traveling.
Yeah, exactly. Just so people know, I was initially averse to recording this pod because there's so many things that I think it's like curse of knowledge where I'm like, is this really interesting? Are people going to get anything from this? And I think if anything, hopefully at least you'll start using purchase protection. I hope that alone pays for your attention and listening to this. But overall, I think it was refreshing to realize, yeah, these are all things that we learned over several years and hopefully people can use them immediately.
Awesome. Shall we end it there?
Yeah, let's end it there. This was the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. If you are interested, we will add specific links in the show notes, including Cal's template for reaching out to Airbnbs. And if you have more questions, you can reach out to us. You can find me at StephSmithIO on Twitter.
And you can find me at Calvin_Rosser on Twitter. Please reach out if you found any of these things useful. It would be great to know what was actually insightful and what was just boring, trite knowledge that everyone already knows.
Yeah, and I guess, Cal, we'll see you at an airport lounge very soon.
Let's hope so.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.